You're listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries. I'm Sarah Rose, and today I'm joined by Alexa Tansley and Diane Halford from In Search of Anne Walker. Do you want to start by just introducing us briefly to Anne Walker? Who was she, and what was it about Anne that made you want to find out more about her?
So Anne Walker is better known as the wife of Anne Lister, who is the very famous resident of Shipton Hall in Halifax and world-renowned diarist. They had not legally recognised, but a marriage in 1834, and they lived together at Shipton Hall until Anne Lister's death in 1840. Like most people, I got to know about Anne Walker through the Gentleman Jack BBC TV show. And it really spoke to me the way that they handled her mental health issues and various other aspects of her life during that. And I became interested in other things about her life. And as I looked more and more into her life, I realised that that some of the things that we thought we knew about her perhaps weren't exactly right. So I've got a background in family history. I've done all my family history research. I'd taught it in adult education. And I wanted to look into Anne Walker's family, so I did that. I was also looking into my own family tree at the same time. And I found some evidence that my grandfather had been divorced. Great-grandfather had been divorced, and I wanted to look at those papers, and they're kept in the National Archives. So I decided one Christmas to go down to the National Archives, and while I was there, I'd heard lots of talk on different groups on social media about some papers called the Walker versus Gray papers, which was a lawsuit which took place. And I thought, well, I'll go and have a look at those while I'm down there. I might as well. I'm only there for one paper. And whilst I was down there, I'd been reading some articles on some social media groups dedicated to Gentleman Jack and Anne Lister, and there'd been some information about a ship and some names. And while I was down there, I was looking through these papers, and in some accounts I found the name Broderick, which was a name that was mentioned regarding Anne Lister's body, because she died in 1840 in Georgia, related to her body and her coming back to this country. It was assumed that Anne Walker bought Anne Lister's body back from Georgia after she died and travelled with her. But the documents that I found in the National Archives suggested perhaps that she was back home in February 1841, and Anne Lister's body, we know from the newspapers, didn't come back until April 1841. So it suggests that she didn't actually come back with Anne Lister, which then started me thinking about what else do we know about Anne Walker, which isn't actually true. And I started looking more closely at what we knew. When I got back from the National Archives, I reached out to a couple of researchers on one of the social media groups that had been involved in that had posted these things about Anne Walker's body coming back. And I eventually ended up researching with Steve Crabtree and looking at a lot of things about Anne Walker's life post-1840, which is after Anne Lister died. That's me.
So, yeah, so like Diane, I first heard about Anne Walker through the TV show Gentleman Jack. And I guess what struck me is as the show went on, you know, I guess the show was primarily about Anne Lister and her life, but as the show went on, I just became more and more intrigued about, you know, the other character, you know, Anne Walker, particularly about her mental health and her struggles and how she came to the decision to marry in the way that she did. So I was really quite fascinated in terms of this was the first I'd heard about this relationship. But what really struck me was I saw a post on social media during the time the TV show was on in the UK. And it was a picture of the little marker in the churchyard at Lightcliffe to show where Anne Walker was buried. And it really struck me that there was no memorial for this person who had such a... the couple of them were the first to really... that were aware of the first lesbian marriage, if you want to call it that. And they actually hold a really significant part in the history of LGBTQ people. So I was really keen to ensure we had to get a memorial for her. Quickly, from speaking to the vicar of St Matthew's in Lightcliffe, I quickly became aware it wasn't just as simple as putting in an application and getting one, simply because the churchyard is a closed churchyard, which means no changes can be made to it. So that then started me on what has been a 3-year journey to get a memorial for Anne Walker, which is still ongoing, and we can chat a bit more about that later. But in terms of how Diane, Steve and I started working together and becoming in search of Anne Walker, I'd come across the work that they were doing around the research into Anne Walker, and I thought, actually, learning more about her and that research side of thing, as well as looking at the legacy piece and how we can remember her from now on, actually worked really well together. So I got in touch with the two of them, and In Search of Anne Walker was born.
Yeah, and the importance of putting together the website that we have, In Search of Anne Walker.com, was because we'd been asked to do an Anne Lister birthday weekend live by Pat Escape, because she'd heard about Steve and I's research into Anne Walker post 1840. And we just realised we'd need a repository, somewhere to put our research, because we knew that people would ask questions. We knew that there was lots of information that we had that perhaps other people hadn't come across yet. And we wanted to get it out there. And that's always been our mission statement for In Search of Anne Walker. It's always been about getting the full story of Anne Walker out there.
One thing that struck me is that Anne Walker tends to be represented as being quite meek and passive. But the more I look into her, the more I think that's really not the case. I wonder if you want to talk about what looking through her travel journal, which we'll talk a bit more about later, but also her letters have told you about her personality, and in particular about her strength and determination.
Well, it's amazing when you actually read letters that she's written, and, as you say, the journal entries, you get a distinct impression that she knew what she wanted. And clearly she did in actions as well, in terms of Anne Lister. You know, she knew she wanted to live with her, and she did, against, you know, societal and family pressure. So I think she very much was able to speak up for herself when she needed to. There's incidents where she's dismissed tenants, dismissed people that worked for her. There's, you know, her very strong opinions of, if you did a travel guide, Anne Walker's travel guide of her honeymoon destination, she's got very strong opinions on some of the places that she went to. I mean, at the end of the day, the story of Anne Walker traditionally has been told from the point of view of Anne Lister. And now we are doing more research, and we're not the only ones. There's lots of people doing research into it, and we celebrate all kinds of research into Anne Walker. You know, when you look in the archives, look at original documents written by her and about her, we're getting a completely different person coming out than what people originally thought, whether that's through research. And of course, we are about the real Anne Walker. So we're trying to tell a story about what truly happened to her.
And I think what was really clear when we started looking into it is that the majority of the views of Anne Walker have always been from Anne Lister's diary, which is very much written the way that Anne Lister portrays their relationship and the things she chooses to talk about. And actually, by being able to read the words of her diary, the words of her letters, we are able to build up that bigger picture. And yeah, Anne Walker will mention things that Anne Lister haven't mentioned in her diary. Actually, you just start to build up the bigger person, don't you?
So from there, do you want to tell us about your dream find of Anne Walker's journal? How did that happen?
Well, the word I like to use is serendipitous. I started going to the archives fairly regularly and trying to look as many Crow Nest papers that I can. Crow Nest being one of the buildings on the very large estate that the Walkers owned around Lightcliffe, Halifax, Honley, lots of different places. And so I was looking through the Crowness papers as normal. But as I was searching for what I was going to look at the next time I went, I came across a document because in 1843, Anne Walker was declared to be of unsound mind. And as a result of that, she spent the rest of her life having committees of her estate and person. So a bit like today's power of attorneys, that somebody looked after her health and well-being and her person and her business, her estates. So I was looking for a committeeship document in the Rawson files. Now, the Rawsons are another well-known Halifax family. There were bankers here, and they've lived for many years in various locations around Halifax. And in that file was a travel journal attributed to Anne Lister. And I'd never seen an Anne Lister diary up close. I'd only ever seen them behind glass at the library. And I thought, well, it's here. It's right in front of me. I'll open it up and have a look. It was a little blue marbled little book. And I opened it up. And the first thing I saw was sort of like Anne Walker's handwriting. But I couldn't quite believe it. It's just one of those things that you can't quite believe. I started flicking through it. I was messaging Steve and Alexa at that time going, I think I found a diary. No, I haven't. Yes, I have. No, I haven't. Yes, I have. Because I couldn't quite believe what I was looking at. It was things like she mentions at the back of the diary to Mr. Walker, and the W was written in the way that I know Anne Walker signed a signature. She mentioned visiting her aunt at Cliff Hill. Cliff Hill was another one of the properties over in Lightcliff belonging to the Walker estate. And all of this, I kept thinking, well, maybe it was her sister writing it. I was trying to talk myself out of it, that I've actually found this find. But actually what it was that actually that really sealed it for me was the 19th of January, 1835 entry I looked at, which talked about, it's been 5 years since I lost my poor brother. And then it talked about the Naples. Now, we all know, both from Gentleman Jack TV show and also from historical records, that her the heir to the Walker estate, John Walker, Elizabeth Walker, and Anne Walker's younger brother, had inherited the estates when his father had died. And we know that he died in Naples on his honeymoon in 1830. And that would, he died on 19th of January, so 5 years later would in fact have been, it had to be Anne Walker writing these diaries based on everything else that was put in there. Plus the travel itinerary was the one that we knew she went on with Anne Lister. So we knew it was definitely going to be Anne Walker's journal. The funny thing was, this was October the 20th, 2020. It was right in the middle of all the COVID restrictions that were going on. And of course, the archives also had COVID restrictions. And therefore, the diary, because I'd been looking at it, couldn't be touched for a period of 2 or 3 days. So down the archivist at the time couldn't actually verify that it was. I was excitedly reading out extracts and waving the diary at him, trying to point, but he had to stay a good 2 metres away from me. It was very difficult for him to actually verify it there and then. So we had to wait. We found it on the Tuesday. We had to wait until the Friday before it was verified.
So, so we had 3 days, essentially. You, Diane, had photographed all the different pages of the diary. So we had 3 days, essentially, where we could transcribe it ourselves before anybody else was aware that it had been found, other than us and the archivists. So that was quite a special time, because it felt like we were the first people reading these words. That's probably since it had been written, or presumably it had been put in the files with the Rawson's family information and filed away and rarely looked at since. So it felt quite special to actually be going through and reading those words. We transcribed it over those next 3 days, and what was lovely was, as we went through, we were learning more about Anne Walker. We, for example, we read in there that she called Anne Lister dearest throughout the diary. So little things like that. Again, we're starting to see her personality come through. This was writing. She wasn't writing for anybody else. She was making these notes for herself. And again, these little snippets of personality, for example, one time they're playing backgammon. And Anne Walker writes in her diary, completely beat her. Now, if you look at Anne Lister's diary, I think that refers to her being in, how does she discuss it? She says she's in sort of a bit of a flump about it, and Anne Walker has to encourage her to continue playing. And what's lovely is when you can see the flip side, there's a little bit of gloating there in terms of I beat her in the end, which is really lovely to see. So we had those 3 days, didn't we? And then following on from that, in order that we could produce a full transcription that could be actually at the archives, we pulled together a group of transcribers to work with, didn't we, to do that?
Yeah, so you've been releasing Anne Walker and Anne Lister's diary entries in parallel, haven't you? So you can sort of compare and contrast what they have to say, which is fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So once it had been announced by the archives that we'd found the diary had been rediscovered, people started to get copies of it. So we invited people that were contributors to In Search of Anne Walker to help us fully transcribe it. And as Alexa says, so that it could be up online for everybody to be able to see it. And I have to say, we spent very many post-midnight sessions debating particular words and all their meanings or what it could be. Actually, in the end, it's an amazing group of people that spent so much time dotting I's, quoting Doriana, who was one of the transcribers. There are so many commas, you know, just making sure everything looked perfect. In the end, there was only one word we couldn't figure out. And really, if anyone can figure out what they saw in the alley, please let us know, because we can't. we also, you know, we realised as we were doing this that we could now see events from two sides. So we, you know, we could see Anne Walker's side and we could see Anne Lister's side. And that was the first time that we'd be off to do that. So it was suggested by one of the contributors that we should do side-by-side diary comparisons. So Doriana, again, was a code breaker, which was the code breaker is one of the people that was part of the Anne Lister diary transcription project run by West Yorkshire Archive Service. And so she went through all of the entries for Anne Lister and made sure that they were all accurate. And we put them side by side with Anne Walker. They're still on our website. So we coincided when they came out with the actual day that Anne Walker wrote them. So June the 4th was released on June the 4th last year. And right now we're up to, you know, the today's date, and we'll keep going until there's no more diary entries by Anne Walker, until, fingers crossed, we hopefully find another one somewhere tucked in someone's attic, something like that.
What's it told you about Anne Walker as a person? What's the sort of your takeaway from it?
I got the impression from reading the diary that she's a very headstrong individual. I think Diane said earlier she knows her own mind. She will decide something and she will push for it. She's very opinionated. We refer to it, don't we, as Anne throws shade, because we get a number of in where she'll have real put downs for either a place or an individual. There's one where she talks about these Roman baths and is essentially saying she very much doubts these are Roman baths.
The other thing, what it says to me is their relationship was probably a lot more equal than what people have presumed in the past. She was also clearly used to a very high standard of living, just from the comments when she went to places which perhaps didn't quite meet that standard that she was expecting. And we know this to be true because the Walkers were a very wealthy family in the area.
I would say there are elements of where you can see her mental health isn't as strong as it is some days or some periods through the diaries. There's times, for example, when Anne Lister goes out on a day-long hike, and she's clearly very anxious that day, and she sort of talks about pacing and waiting for her by the window. There's times where she's woken up in the night frightened, and Anne Lister's lit a candle for her. And so you sort of see how their relationship worked and how actually, you know, they were very supportive of one another and what they gave to each other in that relationship.
Absolutely. And sometimes, as is the case with some diary writers, it's actually what they don't mention. So they have an argument when they're abroad because the travel journal covers their travels abroad on their honeymoon, if you will. And they have an argument, and Anne Lister writes quite a lot about it. But and Anne Walker, however, completely disregards the, she doesn't know why they've had an argument, and she sounds as if she doesn't know what's going on. She doesn't mention it, but Anne Lister does. So it's what she doesn't mention sometimes as well. For example, the infamous, if you're a Gentleman Jack fan, you might know about this, the infamous 1934 incident with Anne Lister going to Lawton Hall for Christmas and the things that went on there. When Anne Lister returns from visiting Lawton Hall, Anne Walker writes a couple of lines, and the last thing she says is, "I in bed," whereas Anne Lister writes, you know, that she ran down the stairs to see her, you know. So it's what she doesn't write that I think is important. She was obviously clearly upset with what had happened at Lawton Hall with Anne Lister being away.
I wonder if when she doesn't write very much, but you know there's lots going on, if it's that she doesn't want to write it in a diary, or if it's maybe that she's just a bit less dramatic than Anne Lister and is more sort of straightforward, this happened, this happened.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point about not writing it as well, because one thing, I guess, why Anne Lister's diary is such a fascinating from a historical perspective is because Anne Lister had this code and she could write whatever she wanted to in there, and it, you know, it was many, many years later when it was actually decoded, and even then, it, back in the, was it in the 50s, it wasn't ready to be shared then when that the code was broken. But Anne Walker didn't have that, so she was aware whatever she wrote in there could be read by somebody if it had been picked up. So I think there's an element of She was pretty guarded with how she wrote things as well, definitely.
You mentioned that In Search of Anne Walker is a collaborative project, which is something that I'm a real fan of. So as well as the journal entries, you've also got people working on blogs about Anne Walker's life, her associates, places in Halifax that she mentions. I wonder if you want to tell me a little bit more about that. How did it come about? Who are the other people involved and what are they up to at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, from the start, when Diane, Steve and I got together and decided to create In Search of Anne Walker, we wanted it to be a collaborative project. We knew between three of us there was only so much we could do, and yet there was so much to find out. So we put the call out quite early to say, you know, we want to bring Anne Walker out of the shadows. We want to find out as much as we can about her. And I guess one of the earliest examples of our projects we did was called Anne Walker in the Diaries, which was actually before Diane had found Anne Walker's diary. This was all about looking at the entirety of Anne Lister's diary and finding any reference to Anne Walker in there, or her family, or locations where she lived or where she went to church, with the idea of being, we would then create a searchable database, so people can actually search that information and find out as much as they can in there about Anne Walker. And we're hoping that database to go live later this year, aren't we? So again, that's been a year-long project to pull that together. Diane, do you want to share other examples?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the Anne Walker in the Diary project, we had over 25 people interested. A lot of people had done some transcribing, either for themselves of Anne Lister's diaries, or perhaps for the Codebreaker project, the transcription project that I mentioned earlier. And some people that just wanted to help behind the scenes. So it's been an amazing collection of people for that one project. But then we started to realise that to understand Anne fully, we needed to know about the people around her, those who supported her, those who influenced her. And so that gave rise to the Anne's Associates project that we run. Now, we have an awful lot of people involved in that who have never done historical research before. And they're doing a fantastic job finding out things about people who lived and had connections to Halifax. So some examples of the blogs that we've got Lydia Wilkinson, who was the daughter of Reverend Wilkinson, who was the vicar of Lightcliffe Chapel. She was a good friend of Anne Walker and ended up living with Anne Walker and is mentioned in the 1851 census as a housekeeper, so towards the end of Anne Walker's life. And then we've also got some members of the Rawson family. We've got Catherine Rawson, Delia Elizabeth Rawson. Coming up soon will be John Rawson Jr., who was one of the committees of Anne Walker. He was the committee of her estate when she couldn't look after her own affairs. We've also got guest blogs, so we get people who are interested in a particular subject, and people can write guest blogs for our website as well. An example of that, we've got one on Rawson Bank, which of course was in Halifax itself. So we do lots of, we've got lots of different projects planned, and we've got some behind the scenes going on at the moment, and we encourage anybody that's interested in doing anything. If you've got no historical research background like we didn't have, or any kind of academic background, please, and you still want to do it, that's absolutely fine. There's so much stuff that you can find out and so much stuff that you can do to help bring Anne Walker out of the shadows. Just contact us.
Yeah, I really like it, because I think as someone that works in a library as well, that's one of our aims, is to make research accessible. And there is a perception, isn't there, that you have to have a postgraduate degree in queer studies or whatever to do research, and you don't at all. You just need to have enthusiasm and be able to sort of talk to other people. And I'm with you, I definitely encourage anyone, even if you've never done any research at all, to just have a go and see what you can find out, and you'll end up going down some rabbit hole and researching things you never thought you would do.
Absolutely.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about the other strand of In Search of Anne Walker, which is about the memorial? And also, one thing which I think is really lovely is putting it in sort of modern day context, so raising money for a local food bank and that side of it.
Definitely, yeah. So we, again, when we set up In Search of Anne Walker, we were clear this was going to be sort of almost a two-pronged approach. We would have the research part, so we could find out as much as possible about her and her family and those closest to her, but also ensure we had a legacy to ensure she is remembered for who she was, rather than just the wife of Anne Lister. So I mentioned the memorial earlier. That is what we've agreed, is that we're going to restore her original memorial. So the church at Lightcliffe, where she was buried, that was actually knocked down in the 70s. However, the Friends of Friendless Churches, who are a charity, were able to save the tower of the church. So the tower still stands there in Lightcliffe, just down the road from the new church there. And within that tower, they were able to save some of the memorial plaques, and Anne Walker's memorial plaque from when she was buried is still in there. So that is currently with the, there is one brass restorers in the whole country, and that plaque is currently with them, and they are restoring it to be replaced in the tower. It's going to be put on a stone backing. It's going to be put in a place where it can be seen within the tower, so that, as you know, my understanding is that we're going to continue to open the tower at regular intervals, so that people can go in, pay their respects, and see her memorial in its restored state. So alongside that, as you mentioned, one thing we became aware of when we saw Anne Walker's will is within there she talks about giving £10 a year to the, she refers to them as the poor of Lightcliffe, and this is something, a legacy she was carried on from her uncle, who'd also done something similar in his will. So when we read that, we thought, actually, there's a legacy piece we can bring there. So we decided to raise money around Christmas time each year, doing an annual fundraiser for the local food banks. So this year, for example, we raised money for Brighouse Food Bank, and we're able to raise over £1,600 for them in Anne Walker's name, which is fantastic. And it feels like we're sort of continuing to help the community where she was active in and wanted to help those individuals. So that's been fantastic to do. And again, we're always looking at ways where we can sort of bring her to the forefront in the community in which she lived. And we've got a number of projects in the pipeline, haven't we, to do so.
Ooh, interesting. So we need to keep an eye on your social media over the next few weeks, do we, to find out more? But in the meantime, you've spent a lot of time in West Yorkshire Archives and also the National Archives, haven't you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about some of the correspondence and paperwork that you've found in relation to Anne Walker?
Absolutely. So I'm trying to work my way through the Crowness papers, which are a bunch of papers that are related to the Walker family. And you will find that there are information about Anne Walker in all different folders throughout these files and in other files. I mentioned the Rawson papers as well that are held at the archive in Calderdale. Some of the things I found, so reading through different folders, there's a folder, you know, generically known as the Scottish Estates Papers, but there's a really interesting document there that was written by John Snaith Rymer, who was one of her lawyers during the lunacy proceedings, and it talks about the actual lunacy hearing herself and how Anne Walker talked there, and how he wanted to make sure that she was looked after now this decision had been made that she was of unsound mind. So that was a really nice thing to find, because it's the only document that we have currently, and everything I say is currently because you never know what's around the next corner, that we have that talks about the actual lunacy hearing itself. There's a great, I've just discovered a great court document relating to a court case to do with the Rawsons, actually, but it is linked to the Walkers, because it's related to Fanny Penfold, or Frances Penfold, who was married to John Walker, the heir of the Walker estate, Anne Walker's brother. And she was apparently, according to Christopher Rawson in this document, brought up by Christopher Rawson and his wife, Mary Ann Rawson, who happened to be the aunt, Fanny Penfold's aunt. And he really does go on a rant about that he put up the money for her marriage settlement to John Walker, and how much money he'd spent on travelling down to Dover to pick her up, to meet her when she came back from the continent after he died, and even talks about him and his wife separating over it. It's a great document in terms of a historical perspective, and he really does go on a rant. I really enjoyed that document, reading that the other day. Other things we found about Anne Walker: we found letters that talk about the contact that she had with Anne Lister's and her friends after Anne Lister had died. So we know she was still in contact with Mrs. Duffin, the second Mrs. Duffin, who's known as Miss Marsh in the Anne Lister's diaries, because she writes a letter to her. We also know that she sent game birds to her, the Norcliffes, and various products of her estate to people in York. So we know she was in contact with people that knew Anne Lister after she died. So we found information in lots of different archives as well. So the Walker versus Gray files at National Archives was fascinating to look through. Lots and lots of receipts, lots of legalized, big, huge documents of the lawsuit that went on. It's very interesting. If anybody gets a chance to go and see it, to go and have a look. But we've also got in different archives around the West Yorkshire area, we found a letter from Charles Musgrave. He was the Archdeacon of Halifax, I believe, and he wrote to a friend of his regarding the funeral of Anne Walker. We've got a blog on our website about Anne Walker's last days as well. We found many references to it, not in her own hand, but letters written to other people about her last days. It's full of information now. That I was always told that her family had tried to erase her and deleted all of her documents, but fortunately that seems to be not quite the case. There is a lot of stuff that refers to Anne Walker in the archives, in the Crowness papers, letters that she's written. Hopefully we'll continue to find more paper that tell a much more fuller story.
Yeah, one thing I'm really interested in is the relationship with her sister, Elizabeth. Like, how supportive was she of Anne or not? How much did she know about her relationship? That kind of thing.
Yeah, in the Crowness papers in folder 103/4, just happened to know that, which has letters between the sisters. And it's fascinating to read about those. They've just been actually transcribed by one of our contributors, and we'll be doing some more information, putting out more information about that in the coming months.
Oh, I look forward to reading that. The other thing I'm really interested in is the Lunacy Commission. So I guess what were the events leading up to her being declared a lunatic, and how much of that was related to her mental health issues or to do with conforming and not conforming? And we know that she spent some time in an asylum, but then after that, everything's a little bit fuzzy. So I guess you might not have concrete answers, but I wonder what you found out that can give us a bit more information about the series of events.
So when you look at the Lunacy papers and the things that are written about Anne and her mental health at that time, I think it's really important that we look at it not as from today's standards and from today's expectations of what that threshold would be, but actually what was expected in 1843. And the very different set of circumstances, societal norms were very different, expectations of women were very different. And it's important to interpret the documents that we find within that context. So certainly we do know that heading towards September 1843, when she left Shipton Hall, her estate decisions were building up to a crisis point. There was, the courts were involved in numerous lawsuits that she'd been sued over. There was distress warrants. There were people, bailiffs living in Shipton Hall, over a bill from a tenant, a very relatively small amounts of money compared to the Walker fortune. She'd been fined in the courts. She'd made some dodgy deals that weren't considered to be value for money. So there was obviously things going wrong. And I think it's important that you look at the whole picture for Anne Walker and her history to try and see if actually the decision to find her of unsound mind was the correct one or not. And I think that will take a lot more looking into and researching to make sure that we get a much more accurate and fuller picture.
Yeah, it's a tricky area, isn't it? Especially because of the way that people, and in particular women, are treated even now who have mental health issues. You don't want to end up making too many assumptions, do you? But it seems like she was kept under a kind of power of attorney until her death. As far as we know, she wasn't released from it. Is that right?
As far as we know, yeah. So it was, you know, looking into who were her committees, it started off to be George Mackay Sutherland and her sister, Elizabeth. And then after her sister Elizabeth died in 1844, at the end of 1844, I believe they tried to get Lydia Fenton, Lydia Wilkinson, who I mentioned earlier, to be a committee of person, but for some reason that never happened. So George Mackay Sutherland took on the committee of person as well as estate. And after George Mackay Sutherland died in 1847, the two roles were divided from her aunt, Harriet Dyson, who became the committee of her person. And the committee of her estate was a cousin by marriage, John Rawson Jr. And they remained, certainly they remained until her death in 1854. But John Rawson Jr. was still in court representing Anne Walker under various lawsuits until the 1860s, 70s.
Wow. And there's a little bit about that on your website already, isn't there? There's sort of the last days and the Lunacy Commission and all that kind of stuff that people can read about.
Yeah, there's also, we've got an article on where Anne Walker was during those last years as well. So, you know, sometimes people assume that she was in an asylum until she died, or yeah. Aunt Anne Walker came and took her out of the asylum. And a lot of these things have been kind of proven not necessarily to be true. For example, we know that she was probably in the asylum for 6-7 months, went down to London area with her sister and brother-in-law, George Mackay Sutherland. And after the death of her sister, George Mackay Sutherland and Anne Walker returned back to Shipton Hall. That would have been 1845. And we know that Anne Walker remained at Shibden Hall until after the death of her aunt in 1847. We found a document that, an account document that says that the housekeeper at Cliff Hill was paid extra money for moving Ann Walker into Cliff Hill in January 1848. And we know from census that she was still in Cliff Hill in 1851. So we know that she wasn't in the asylum for years, or that she didn't go back and live with her aunt, just from, you know, addresses, letters from other people. There's very little written by Ann Walker post 1843 that we have, but we rely on records and information from other people.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the records, because I guess it's very easy, and you want to avoid just being like, I found this mention in a particular record, and therefore this is what's happened, and make it sort of completely concrete. I wonder, how do you decide when to sort of publish something and you've got enough evidence that you think this definitely is what happened, and when are you like, ooh, maybe this could suggest something, or but, you know, we don't know 100%. Because I guess... because there's been sort of fallacies throughout the years. At some point, somebody's seen something and been like, oh, this is what must have happened to Ann Walker. She must have been removed from Shibden Hall. And you want to avoid kind of creating a different narrative that isn't necessarily correct.
We try to be quite careful when we're writing things. We try to say, it's intimated in this letter. We don't say this is a fact, or we might say... and I think most of the things that we write will have a little caveat at the bottom that will say, this is how we're telling the story at the moment, but this story may change depending on what we find. But in terms of standard of proof, if you will, we try and get information from a number of different sources before we decide on something. So, for example, the assumption that she went down to London after leaving the asylum is based on a letter that her sister wrote saying that we plan to take her out and bring her down to London with us. And then a letter from, a bit later on, a letter from John Snaith Rymer, her solicitor, saying that the Lunacy Commission wants to come and visit George McKay Sutherland, but would also pay a professional visit to Miss Walker at the same time, clearly stating that they were together. And at that time, that was addressed to him in London. So we've got two pieces of evidence there that suggest that's the case. So we were clear to say, you know, that's at the moment, that's what's intimated in these informations. It's hard to say we'll ever get definitive proof of one thing or another, because we don't, you know, people that have read Ann Lister's diaries, they have got this amazing resource of her life. You can say this happened, this didn't happen, this is where she was, this wasn't where she was, you know, this is who she spoke to. We don't have that. And vast majority, I mean, humongous amounts of people will never have that in their life, no matter how famous they are. So it's a real special resource, the Ann Lister diaries. And I think for Ann Walker, what we have to do is we have to piece it together. It's a bit like a jigsaw. You start to make a jigsaw and you start to see a picture, but sometimes you might just have, it might be a jigsaw of a dog, and you might just have an ear and a foot, but you can tell it's a dog, but you haven't got the rest of the middle of it yet. And it's a bit like that. It's a bit like you have to kind of post it together and say, this, we think this is going to look like a dog when it's finished, but actually, you know, it might turn out that it's a, you know, some kind of hybrid creature we've never seen before. But at the moment, you have to kind of make your assumptions based on your best guess about her whole life and what's likely to have happened. And if she, we know that she wasn't in the asylum particularly that long, because we assume she wasn't in the asylum that long, because we've got a doctor's bill that actually ends. The doctor's bill doesn't keep going on. We've got one doctor's bill for Dr. Belcombe. We still don't. We don't see those in 18 under in her accounts that committee ship had to write for the chancery, because all of her accounts were looked at by the chancery every year as a way of keeping, you know, keeping her estate safe. And we don't see them again. So we know that she clearly wasn't being paid for care. So she must have been out. And if she was out, the rules were that she had to live with a committee, or she had to live close to a committee. The committee couldn't, for example, George McKay Sutherland wanted to be the committee and live up in Scotland, and he was told he couldn't do that. He had to be close to her. So if you bear all that in mind, he was a committee, they had to be close to one another. And and she wasn't in an asylum. It's about looking at whole pieces of evidence and not just one individual piece, if that makes sense. It's a bit like a detective story, really.
Yeah, and yeah. I think it's looking at why, with the sources, why they were written as well. So you might have, as you say, a doctor's bill or a solicitor's letter where there's no reason for bias in such a thing, whereas you might have letters between family members where they could, you know, prone to exaggeration, or there might be some, there's a political spin on it. So it's really, there's that side of things as well as how much actually, how much can we put on this piece of, yeah, of evidence.
Yeah.
So currently all the research is on your website. It's open source, which means people can just go on and read it for free. I wonder if you wanted to talk a little bit about the decision to make it open source, because sometimes there can be a bit of suspicion about research that isn't in a printed journal or book.
I mean, in terms of making things publicly accessible, this was always what we wanted to do from day one. This was about making sure other people knew about Ann Walker, you know, and having that. So actually, if people are interested in writing a book or whatever, again, we'd encourage people to get in touch and very happy to share that information.
Yeah, so we want to get the most accurate story we can at the moment out there, because there'll always be something that will come along. Hopefully there'll always be something that will come along that could actually change the way we look at everything, you know, and that would be fantastic. We're all about that. We're absolutely happy to say, this is what we found so far. This is what we've drawn the conclusions from this document. But absolutely, if something else comes along that disproves that or adds more information, we'll absolutely welcome that. If anybody has information and they want to share it with us, or if you need information for something you're putting together, people are more welcome to contact us. We do a lot of sharing of our knowledge with other people, just simply because it's about, for us, it's not about holding on to that information. It's about getting the information out there in the best ways we can possible. I mean, as Alexa said earlier, we both got full-time jobs. This is a part-time passion for us, not a full-time. I mean, I would love to do it full-time, but I've got to pay the bills somehow. So, you know, it's really just about getting all that we find out about Ann Walker out there, so people have the latest up-to-date knowledge, the more breadth of knowledge and a base that they can go and return to in the website if they need to think, well, I can't quite remember what happened there, and they can pop in and see it. And you're quite right, there's lots of other excellent resources out there that mention Ann Walker as well, and we're really just about, we want to get the story out. And for us, and we will say it again, it doesn't really matter who's finding the information out, as long as the information out there is accurate and telling the true story of Ann Walker, we'll 100% support it.
Fantastic. So I will put a link to your website in the show notes so people can check it out for themselves. But I just wanted to talk very briefly about April. So this April 2022, we've got Ann Lister Birthday Week with loads and loads of events related to Ann Lister. But we've also got an Ann Walker Day. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that day and what you've got planned for it?
Oh, absolutely. We're so excited about Ann Walker having her own day, and we can't thank the organisers of ALBW enough for that, you know, giving her due. So we've got a couple of events in the daytime which haven't been announced as recording this, so I can't say too much about them. And we've got also, we're talking in the Minster on the evening, and we're also putting together a Walker Tavern event at night, which is going to be, you know, a bit of a fun event for people to come along and have a bit of a dance, and puffy sleeves and fancy dresses optional, but it'll just be a fun time to get together and celebrate Ann Walker. Yeah, no, we're very excited about Ann Walker Day, aren't we?
Yeah, and we've got, as well as In Search of Ann Walker, there are others getting involved in the day as well. Oh, so yeah. David Glover will be involved from the Halifax Antiquarian Society.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Ian Philp from Friends of St Matthews. They're both speaking in the Minster with us. So we'll get a sort of a range of views and information about the research that's happening to Anne Walker across her life, which will be possibly for many, it'll be the first time they've been able to access sort of that real spread of, you know, I'm sure you're aware there aren't, as of yet, there aren't books written about Anne Walker and her life. So actually to be able to come and learn that information, I think will be fascinating for many people. I know on that day there will be tours around Lightcliff as well for individuals to see where Anne Walker lived, her different residences, as well as being able to see the memorial as well, the restored memorial. There'll be the options to do that. And more than anything, I think it's a chance for people to ask those questions as well and to come along and have some of those myths disproved, which have been around for so long. I remember one of the first times I went to Lightcliff, I was speaking to a resident there, and she said, "Oh, Anne Walker, I know her. She was the woman who went mad and got locked away." And that was what was known about her locally. And I think actually to be able to bring this information out of the shadows and to be able to share it, so you know, that this rounded person can actually be learnt about and celebrated as well, I think is super important. So yeah, really looking forward to that day.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, presented and produced by Sarah Rose and Jill Carpenter. Now, there's a couple more events being announced since we recorded this episode. So In Search of Anne Walker are going to be doing workshops about Anne Walker's journal and also about the letters to her sister Elizabeth in April. So keep an eye on social media for details on how to book those. For our next episode, Jill is going to be delving back into folklore and talking about Robin Hood and Robin Hood's grave.